So.
Well, thanks. Well, it's great to be here. I think this will be a change of pace. This will be sort of more cellular recordings and not as much model. And I wanted to begin talking about working memory because I think you've heard bits and pieces of this. And I'm going to talk to you mostly about research from my lab on in vitro model of working memory. And I want to sort of, I think will probably be refresh you with sort of the classic work on defining what working memory is, and then go into different possible mechanisms of this. And sort of the simplest example of working memory is if you just have two cups and you put the ball under one of those cups. If you ask a child to do this, they can tell you which cup the ball is under using their parietal cortex. As long as they can attend to it, they can do that at a very early age. But if, say, an elephant walks into this room and the child is distracted because they look at the elephant, they can't then tell you which cup the ball is on until about age two. And that corresponds to the time that the projections, reciprocal projections between the prefrontal cortex and medial dorsal thalamus develop. And so that implicates prefrontal cortex in this sort of working memory that allows you to maintain, in this case, which cup the ball is on as a memory. It's not just in parietal cortex. And this is studied in monkeys often using a variation on that, which is a delayed response task. Right? And so this work I'll mention is from Pat Goldman and Rakesh, and other labs have done this, where they train a monkey to attend to a cue, visual fixation point, and then one of these lights goes on in the periphery, and then that light's on for just half a second, and then when that light goes off, the fixation point remains on, and then after a few seconds to test the actual memory, this fixation point goes off, and then the monkey has to say that it remembered where the stimulus was. And it makes an isochod in that direction, say if this light was on. And this is a very nice test because you can record extracellularly in prefrontal cortex, and you reveal in this test three types of activity patterns, two of which are trivial. So there are neurons whose activity, this is a histogram of the firing rate of extracellularly recorded prefrontal neurons, their firing rate increases during the cue presentation out here. And there are also neurons that are somehow premotor, whose firing rate increases when the isochod is occurring. Right? So those two are expected. This delay period is what was interesting about this story. Right? And so these are neurons here in prefrontal cortex who increase their firing rate during this delay period where the monkey has to remember which position the light was on. And this is called delay period activity, and there's evidence that actually links this to the memory. And so in this study, the monkeys were not perfect, and if you segregate the trials where the monkey made the correct saccade, presumably remembered where the stimulus was, from the examples where the monkey made the incorrect saccade, you don't see this increase in delay activity when the monkey made an incorrect mistake. So this implicates this delay period activity in actually storing the information. So the problem is that this has been known now for four decades, and we still don't understand how this happens. We still don't understand the cellular mechanism, certainly at the level that my laboratory likes to think about in terms of the local circuitry that you might study in brain slices. We don't know how to connect local circuit function with this delay activity period, and that's what we're interested in. And I'm going to show you examples from my lab in a part of the brain called the dentate gyrus, where we think we found in the slice an experimental system that mimics some of these behaviors. And so I'm going to talk about four things. First is I'll show you the phenomena. I'll show you examples of one type of mechanism that could explain this, which is an intrinsic cell autonomous precision firing mode. And then what we found was actually a hybrid of a synaptic and an intrinsic mechanism. And then I'll show you in a slice how this system actually appears to store information.
Question?
Yes.
So you show us that data from the Goldman-Rakic lab, which is in prefrontal cortex, and now you're going to talk about hippocampus. And I thought that the agreement in prefrontal cortex was that the recurrence was not that persistence was not intrinsic, a property of individual cells, but due to the high recurrence in the circuit. So it's a network property. But so here, are you going to argue that the hippocampus is different, or are you going to argue that maybe even in prefrontal cortex, they are cells that have this persistent activity as an intrinsic property of individual cells?
Okay, so there are several questions there. So the first, let me just address first that this delay period activity is most famous for recordings in prefrontal cortex, but that's not the only place that you see it. All right, and you also see it in the hippocampus, and you see it in particular in the dentate hyalus area that we're going to be talking about. No one knows what the mechanism underlying the in vivo recorded persistent activity is. It could be a recurrent network, and that's what we actually set out to test in our slice model.
So you're saying that even in prefrontal cortex, one doesn't know whether it's an
intracellular
property or an
intracellular property. It is, yeah. It's one of the fundamental questions that has been known for four decades that this occurs,
okay.
But there are various models, but how it actually functions isn't known. All right.
Did you say that it's seen in vivo?
Nobody knows.
It has been reported by Colombo and Gross in vivo in a delayed response task in the dentate gyrus, presumably in the hyalus based on their recordings. So this is a famous picture of the hippocampus from Cajal. And what we're going to be talking about in the beginning is an area that actually isn't in his picture. So we're going to be talking about this area between the granule cells, underneath the granule cells and the dentate gyrus, which is called the dentate hyalus, right? And this is the CA3 and the CA1 field here. So it's where what we found is in an relatively obscure part of the hippocampus called the dentate hyalus. There are actually cells there. Wow, this doesn't project so well. There are cells, this is a Nissl stain from a rat hippocampal slice, and there are two types of cells in the hyalus. There are interneurons, GABAergic interneurons, and glutamatergic mossy cells. And the mossy cells are famous for two things. One is that these cells are frequently lost in people who have temporal lobe epilepsy. And there's a form of temporal lobe epilepsy where the predominant damage, and when you look at resected biopsies of the hippocampus, is just these cells in the hyalus. And they can have complex partial seizures that implicates these cells and maybe regulating excitability. And these mossy cells are famous also because they generate a projection. Their axons go predominantly opposite to the lamella organization of the hippocampus. So the granule cells project into the CA3 region here, and those projections form a plane. So if you make a transverse slice of the hippocampus, you preserve largely this projection from the granule cells to CA3. These cells that live in the hyalus go the opposite way. They go to the contralateral side and the distant ipsilateral projections to other lamella. So I'll show you the phenomenon, and then we'll come back to this. Wow, this is unfortunate. Okay, there's a cartoon here.
Do you want to draw it?
Yeah, maybe I'll draw it first. We probably don't need the light. All right. So if this is the granule cell layer in the dentate, right? So the perforant path, or the main inputs that drive the hippocampus, they come from enteronocortical cells, and they synapse on the dendrites of these granule cells, which then go off to CA3. This axon has a name called the mossy fibers. These Hyler cells have very large dendrites, and they get input from these from the axons from the granule cells as they head towards CA3. And so the experiment that we're doing here is to simply stimulate the perforant path input that's left on the slice, and we see an EPSP, and here is a minimal stimulation, so we see failures in EPSPs, and it's delayed by two synapses. So we're activating the enteronal input, that activates the granule cells, then that activates the Hyler cells, and it's blocked by NVQX to show it's glutamatergic. This is stimulating in the perforant path, right? So we're stimulating the inputs to the granule cells that project to the Hyler cell that we're recording from. Right? So there are two EPSP, two synaptic delays, and that's why this EPSP begins 4 or 5 milliseconds after the stimulus. Right? And it's a tip. Other than that, it's a typical glutamatergic EPSP. And this is cell. These Hylar cells are unusual because they have tons of spontaneous activity. This is a recording in a slice without any treatment, and you see all these spontaneous EPSPs occurring here. And when we stimulate at minimal intensities, we sometimes evoke this EPSP, but we don't affect the ongoing synaptic barrage these cells receive. The interesting thing is if we turn up the stimulus intensity, now we're giving two shocks at the perforant path, and if you blew up this area in here, you'd see this EPSP, but we've created now a long-lasting synaptic barrage that lasts for many seconds in a normal hippocampal slice, so without any treatment. We've increased the spontaneous EPSP frequency. And we can quantify this. And so we're just simply measuring the frequency of these EPSPs over a 4-second period before and after this transient stimulation. And we see there's no effect at minimal stimulation, and at super minimal stimulations over many cells, we produce about a 4 or 5-fold enhancement of the frequency of the ongoing synaptic input to these cells.
Just two?
Yes. It could also work with one, but this is the idea is that this is a transient stimulus that produces a long-lasting change in the synaptic input.
This EPSP is caused by multiple inputs. You stimulate the fibers, so you actually probably drive multiple synapses, or?
The synapses that we're driving here to make the fast events are two synapses. Where the spontaneous EPSPs come from is not known.
So it's really two synaptic inputs are enough to
start this? We're stimulating in the perforant path, and what we're driving to make the fast response is two synaptic, local circuit that has two synapses. And a consequence of that transient input is this prolonged increase in the EPSPs, spontaneous EPSPs those cells get.
I'm trying to get a feeling of how much input this, how much spikes this stimulation of the perforant path actually.
A
big event or a small event? That's
you're asking how, like for instance, how many granule cells we're activating by this? We haven't looked at that. This is not a large stimulus, so in absolute terms, this might be 30 or 40 microamps. So it's relatively, it's larger than minimal stimulation, but in this case, so we're here, we're looking at, do we get this phenomenon? We don't get it at minimal or twice minimal, but at 3 times minimal, we see it about 70% of the time as a statistical increase in the EPSP bombarding the cells. And at tenfold higher than minimal intensities, nearly all of the cells show it. But we haven't addressed how widespread the initial activation is. And so this is a very different kind of phenomenon. And this is recording from neocortex. And this is the typical thing that people see. You study brain slice physiology in almost any cortical area. As you increase the stimulus intensity, you see this interplay between excitation and inhibition. And as you increase the intensity, inhibition tends to win. So you tend, the harder you stimulate, the more and more you recruit inhibition, and the more and more you truncate into the EPSP here. And in the Hylas, you see the opposite. At a low intensity stimulation, you see this weak response, and you've recruited more excitation for some reason by stimulating harder. So it's the opposite of what happens in most cases when you stimulate in the hippocampus and neocortex.
So in the left, then what left? Do you think it's GABA-B because it's so prolonged?
Yes. Yes, this is without any pharmacology. So this is showing the two phases of the IPSP and what's left of the EPSP. That gets smaller and smaller as the IPSP truncates it. And so this isn't a slice, and this is an intracellular recording of MOSI cell. This is showing that many cells in the Hylas are doing this, though not all. And this is sort of similar to the working memory studied in vivo. So there's a transient stimulus, and there's a persistent response in both cases. Here we know this is associated with a memory because of the error trials. Here we show at the end that we can actually use this to store information in the slice. So there's an argument that this might be mechanistically similar, but this is in a different brain area than this was recorded from, and this is a slice.
Can you store more than one bit of information on and off?
Yes, but I'll get to that at the end. So the obvious explanation for this would be that somehow we're activating the cells that drive these Hyler cells, and that they're spiking, causing all this synaptic barrage in downstream cells. And this is a granule cell. It's filled with Alexa. It's recorded using two-photon microscopy. And we see the cell is intact, but when we stimulate, the cell has an iPSP. Right? So this cell is not activated in a way that would be expected based on the downstream readout. So the EPSP barrages that we see wouldn't be produced by this cell, and all the granule cells that we recorded from either don't respond or have this inhibitory response. So the most likely candidate to mediate this synaptic barrage isn't activated. And so what's left is sort of searching through two different types of mechanisms. So there's a type of persistent activity that's cell autonomous, and I'll show you a few examples of that. And then there's what we had the question already on, is this classic view from Hebb, and probably earlier than Hebb, that you could have a persistence triggered by a transient input due to recurrent activity. So if enough excitatory cells are connected together, that transient input could start a loop going here that could maintain itself after the input's gone. So these are sort of the two classic ideas of how this could happen. Let's say a little bit, there are many examples of what I call irregular intrinsic persistent activity. This is in a paper from spinal cord neurons showing that as you depolarize the cell, you initially have no real response after the step, but as you step harder and harder, you see an after depolarization. And then that after depolarization can trigger some spikes, but those spikes die off continuously, so their frequency slows down all the way through. And the other example, so this is irregular because it's not maintained, but it's an after depolarization. And the other famous example is from the entorhinal cortex. And some pyramidal cells in the entorhinal cortex have this effect where you can have a regular or tonic firing that's initiated by a transient stimulus. Right? This example has to be modulated. These cells have to be modulated by activating a muscarinic cholinergic receptor. So they normally have a very large after hyperpolarization following this kind of step. Right? But if you suppress that after hyperpolarization with, in this case, carbachol, you reveal this magic intrinsic firing state, tonic firing state that's triggered by a single step. In the olfactory bulb, there's actually a cell that does this that doesn't require any modulation. It does it normally. And this was sort of a bizarre discovery from my lab several years ago. So I had a student who loved alternative things, and he was looking at granule cells, which are the main inner neurons in the olfactory bulb. And this is what an DIC image of the granule cell layer in the olfactory bulb in a slice looks like. And these stripes of these small inner neurons. And he saw occasionally these large cells. And amazingly, no one had looked at these cells before. I guess the assumption was that these were dying cells that were exploding as they decay. But when he patched it, these cells actually had larger action potentials than the inner neurons nearby. And so this turned out to be a nice story because Cajal actually had described these cells. And he had described these cells and named them for his former medical student, Blanas. And when Todd reconstructed these cells, they had exactly the same morphology that Cajal had predicted 100 years ago and no one had found. So we had the first physiological recordings from these cells, and they had this tonic intrinsic persistent firing. So if you activate the cell, you see this ADP like in the spinal cord neurons. But if you are at the right voltage, you see a persistent firing mode that can last for minutes. That's completely tonic and very different than the same protocol in the granule cell. So this is, without any pharmacological treatment, is an example of a cell that has an intrinsic persistent firing mode. And in this case, the firing mode for the cell doesn't vary very much by changing the step voltage. So if you step to a higher and higher potential, so you trigger more spikes during the step, you don't change the persistent firing state very much. But there is a range of this firing frequency from about 3 to 12 or 15 hertz over many of these cells. So this is a case where this cell, which turns out to be inhibitory, produces persistent firing at a relatively fixed frequency. In enteronocortical cells, Angel Alonzo's group had shown that you can actually step to different firing frequencies. So if you have a cell that's not firing and you give a transient depolarization, you produce a few spikes that aren't shown here. And if you step again, you increase that frequency and so on and so on. And this is a power spectrum of these showing the frequencies going up and up and up as you step higher and higher. Right? So this is the idea that this cell might have multiple states in it. All right, so the problem is that, as in prefrontal cortex, our Hyler cells didn't display this property. So when we depolarized them in the same conditions that we see this persistent firing, persistent synaptic barrage, we don't see anything like this cell autonomous intrinsic firing mode. And this should say that the work in enteron cortex and the olfactory bulb, this behavior is unaffected whether or not you block all the synapses. Right? So it's just this one cell going into a persistent firing mode when you depolarize it.
And this is the MOSI cell that
we're This using. Is an example of an olfactory bulb interneuron,
okay.
But we don't see this in the MOSI cell. Right? And you don't see this in prefrontal cortical cells when you make slices of that brain area, right, under normal conditions.
Is it known what the mechanism is in the olfactory bulb?
The mechanism of the intrinsic ADP is known. It's a ICANN current. The molecular basis isn't known, but it behaves as if it's an ICANN current. So it's eliminated by blocking intracellular calcium signaling with BAPTA. You can mimic it with uncaging calcium. And it's partially blocked by flufomanic acid. But the pharmacology for the underlying mechanism ICANN is a mess. So this, in our in vitro model, this doesn't appear to explain it. And so we're left with sort of the predominant view from theory, but not shown by experiments yet, that there might be a reverberation. And so we thought this might be the first example where you can go in a tractable system where you can do the recordings to see, can you have a transient input create a persistent firing mode through synaptic reverberation. And so a student in my lab, Phil Larimer, did the paired recordings. So there were 502 paired recordings to test this. And this was in slices, but we had the advantage that we knew our global phenomena worked in the slice. So we knew that when we stimulated the perforant path, we could create this long-lasting synaptic barrage. So if it was mediated by reverberation, whatever circuits that were left in the slice had to be there to support that. So if reverberation between these glutamatergic Hyler cells mediated this activity, we expected to see that circuit. And in fact, we didn't. So we found lots of connections from MOSI cells to interneurons. We found lots of connections from interneurons to MOSI cells, and even some connections between interneurons that are all monosynaptic, but almost no connections between the excitatory cells. So the connection probability was 0.5%. Which meant it took a lot of these pairs to get to this.
Would there be conjunctions?
It could be, but we can block them we've tried a couple of different blockers and it doesn't eliminate this effect. And we don't see much in the paired recordings, we didn't see much coupling, direct coupling when we tested it directly. So this was, in our hands, the most direct test for whether reverberation could mediate this. And the synapses that could mediate it, recurrent connections between excitatory cells, weren't there. And so we also can cut off CA3, we can cut off enteronal cortex, and we can still see this synaptic barrage. We expect that there was some cell that was firing persistently because we could look at cross correlations. So we could look at whether, when we do a paired recording from other cells, do we ever see EPSPs that occur simultaneously at a frequency more than we'd expect, and we do see that. Although it's not huge, but we see that occasionally. So that suggested that there might be some cells that were actually firing, as opposed to this being a non-specific effect. So imagine that you might stimulate and release potassium or some signaling molecule from glia that would spread through the slice that produces. It looked like this was actually driven by spiking that was specific to the stimulus. And this was not pathological. So this could be done over and over again that didn't interfere with the intrinsic properties of the cell. So for us, the breakthrough came when we found the cells by blind luck by searching for which part of the slice might have activity along with these Hilar cells. And we found that there were units in the inner molecular layer, which unfortunately doesn't show up in here. So this is the dentate granule cell layer. The edge of the granule cell layer is out here. And this is the molecular layer in here. And the inner part, right, has cells that we found that had a persistent firing in extracellular recordings. Right? And we recorded that here's a unit. These cells go about the same time as these Hilar cells spike. And we do cell attached recordings from these cells in the inner molecular layer. And they had persistent firing. And nearby granule cells, the more common cells here, don't have persistent firing.
So these are planar cells, but they are in the molecular layer. They are.
Yes, there are variation on that, on a granule cell. I'll show you a picture in a moment. And then we do the intracellular recordings. We see these beautiful plateau potentials in these cells that we call semilunar granule cells. I'll show you in a minute why. So this is a granule cell, and this is a nearby semilunar granule cell. And its response to increasing intensity stimulation in the perforant path. So the granule cell either doesn't respond or has inhibition. And we see that when we look at the integral of the voltage response here. And these semilunar granule cells develop its ADP and eventually have this plateau state. And the firing that comes from the plateau state is neither in the classic case of the spinal cord neurons, irregular, where it's maximal immediately after the stimulus and then decays, nor is it tonic, like the Blondus cell or the anorhinal cell. So it has more interesting structure here. And this is, you lose some of the spiking in the intracellular recordings, or better to look at the cell attached recording to see the firing pattern of these cells.
And do these cells have massive projections back onto the cell?
Yes, I'll show you that in two slides, I think. All right, so this is a recording from the semilunar granule cell. So this is the granule cell layer. This is a comparison granule cell. So we have a patch clamp electrode that's filled with Alexa. This is on a two-photon imaging microscope, so we can see, while we're recording from the cell, we can see its dendritic structure. So both of these cells are granule-like in that they're polarized. So their dendrites go this way, and their axons go this way. And they're spiny. But the semilunar granule cells have dendrites that span a much larger region of the molecular layer than the granule cells. And they also have these weird axon collaterals that are in the molecular layer that the granule cells never have. And then they have collaterals in the hilus and an axon that heads out to CA3. So this axon heading out to CA3 and this polarization of the dendrites makes it look like a granule cell. Right? But the granule cells never have collaterals in the molecular layer, and their dendrites tend to be covering a much smaller range. This is a blow-up of some of these semilunar granule cells have axons that go and appear to hug the border between the granule cell layer there and the inner molecular layer. Right? And so it turns out Cajal had described these cells also 100 years ago, and no one had followed up on them. And these he called semilunar, perhaps because he ran out of students to name his cells at. But they're called semilunar because in some cases their cell bodies are shaped more like a half moon, whereas a granule cell's cell body is more shaped like an egg. but these are not hard and fast rules. But this is a drawing of Cajal showing some of these cells with the dendrites going out over a much broader range and axon collaterals in the molecular layer. So these are two cells that had been clearly described by Cajal more than 100 years ago, and no one had done anything on them. And in the olfactory bulb, the layer that Cajal described the Blahnik cells, he describes six other cell types that no one's ever recorded from. So there is sort of amazing, 100 years later, there's this vast, potentially vast number of new cells to go after. So this, though, turned out to be key. So these granule cells are very numerous, and they have these very relatively narrow dendritic fields. So they listen to probably a small fraction of the interneuron input coming into the hippocampus. The semilunar cells are much more infrequent, but have a broader dendritic expanse. So they might listen to a much broader selection of interneuronal inputs. And they have these beautiful plateau potentials that the granule cells don't have. They also have much less spike frequency adaptation. So this is highly dependent on how you do this experiment, but if you have relatively little calcium buffering, granule cells tend to adapt completely in this internal, whereas semilunar granule cells adapt, but not as dramatically as the granule cells. Yes?
The axon collaterals didn't seem to target the dendritic crease. There are no recurrent connections?
Well, yes. So we think they're polarized so that they can't hit the dendrites of other semilunar granule cells. They might hit the dendrites of granule cells, and there are also interneurons there. So we haven't been able to do the paired recording yet to see where the molecular layer targets of these cells go. But we've done the paired recording to show that they hit the Hiler cells. And that's this slide. So this is a two-photon guided paired recording. So this is a case where we also have a dual patch clamp system on a two-photon microscope, and we can fill the semilunar granule cells. We patch that cell first, fill it with an Alexa, and then follow the axon. And as we can see where the axon goes, we can go and try and patch cells that are near where that axon comes through. And so it's a much more efficient way of trying to do paired recordings. And so this is this cell, the semilunar granule cell, when we activate it, produces glutamatergic EPSPs on Hiler cells, in this case a Mossi cell, and it's completely blocked by glutamate receptor antagonists. So this is a conventional glutamatergic cell, but has these unusual dendritic properties and unusual plateau potentials. Since it's a two-photon guided paired recording, we actually see where the synapse is. So this is the presynaptic cell filled with Alexa, and this is a Mossi cell and a second recording electrode. And the contact, the only contact here, this is a compressed Z-stack, but the only contact was here on a tertiary dendrite about 70 microns from the soma. So using this technique, we can get the paired recording as well as the localization of the synapse. And granule cells tend to synapse on the proximal parts of these dendrites. That's what these Mossi cells are called, Mossi, because their proximal dendrites are covered with these big postsynaptic spines, which are the terminations of the regular granule cells. So this suggests that maybe these semilunar granule cells hit on the more distal dendrites. So we know that this cell has plateau potentials that are triggered by this perforin path stimulation. We know it's glutamatergic and it drives Hiler cells. So we're trying to put the pieces together and test whether this could really mediate this synaptic barrage we see, the Hilers. And so both the cell attached and the Hiler EPSPs have a similar time course. So if you average many responses, in this case from six cells, you see that this tends to decay over this 20-second period here. The plateau-driven firing in the semilunar cells and the EPSPs you record from cells have similar but not exactly the same time course. And when you look in detail, as you drive the semilunar granule cell, you see a threshold effect. So weaker perforin path stimulation, this is four shocks to the perforin path, produces these disynaptic EPSPs in the Hiler cells and produces monosynaptic EPSPs in these semilunar cells. And if you turn up the intensity, you see At this intensity, it triggered, in this paired recording, a plateau potential in the semilunar cell and a synaptic barrage in here. And if you look at, you blow this area up here, you see each response, each perforant pass stimulation here triggered a little bit of a higher plateau potential, and that correlated with an increased frequency of these synaptic inputs. So this is correlative, suggesting that these semilunar granule cells might relate to the synaptic barrage.
This was not really paired recordings of two connected cells, right?
This is a paired recording, but they're not connected, right? They're simultaneous, but
you had a correlation, but it was not perfect, I guess. You could have plateau potential without persistent response in.
Right. And we can also relate, in this slide, we can relate the frequency that we see each semilunar cell fire at, right? So the best way for us to look at that firing frequency is in cell-attached recordings where we don't perturb the cell more than with the intracellular recording. And these cells tend to fire in this range of 6 to 10 or 12 hertz. But the EPSP barrages are much more frequent, so that if you count the EPSPs coming onto a Hiler cell, they're in the range of 30 or 40 hertz. And when we did the paired recordings, we see a probability of one semilunar cell activating an EPSP and one Hiler cell at about half. So this suggests that at a minimum, there's probably 5 or 6 or 7 semilunar cells activated to produce this Hiler barrage. Right, probably many more. But it's certainly not one-to-one. And that's part of the magic of the system that lets it store more information. So we approach the question, so we say that these are glutamatergic cells, they have different properties, and we show that there's persistent firing triggered by plateau potentials in these semilunar granule cells. So how do you connect to say, is this plateau potential driving this downstream synaptic barrage? And we were lucky that we could find three different treatments that didn't affect the ongoing synaptic transmission. So you can put on a receptor antagonist for AMPA receptors, and that stops the persistent firing, but that's not informative because it stops everything, right? So you want to do something that might interfere with the plateau potentials in these semilunar granule cells without blocking regular AMPA receptor-mediated synaptic transmission, and ask, does that also block this network plasticity you see in Hiler cells? And Nickel was one example that abolished the plateau potential here in the semilunar cell. And so this is before and after Nickel treatment, and also abolished the synaptic barrage. So it didn't abolish the spontaneous synaptic drive. These cells are still receiving spontaneous EPSPs, and they were still receiving the evoked disynaptic EPSP, and that's what's shown here. So that's not affected, but it did block this. So that suggests that this plateau in the semilunar granule cell is what's driving this synaptic barrage in the Hiler cell. And so this is quantifying. We looked at both the EPSP onto the semilunar granule cell and the disynaptic EPSP onto the Hiler cell as two different controls, and neither of them were affected. And if we look at the integral of this plateau to get the long-lasting effect, that was affected by Nickel, as was the increase in the frequency of these EPSPs in downstream cells. So we can block the plateau, and at the same time, we always block the Hiler downstream readout, and it's independent of the normal synaptic transmission. We could also do this with MK801, which is an antagonist, the non-competitive antagonist for NMDA receptors. That also blocked the plateau potential, and it blocked this synaptic barrage, and we could eventually wash out this antagonist, and then we could recover this response in Hiler cells. And this, I'm not showing it, but you can also do this with L-channel calcium antagonists, dihydropyridines. So we have three different pharmacological treatments that don't affect the connections between these cells, but affect the plateau potential. And then those always abolish the downstream hyalur cell. So downstream hyalur synaptic barrage. So that's the argument that this is causative, that the plateau potentials in these semilunar granule cells produce persistent spiking in these cells, which are a rare but presumably more interconnected population of cells that then produce the synaptic barrage. The other thing that's unusual about these semilunar granule cells is that they receive a much denser input from perforant path, and that might explain why they have these plateau potentials. They have lots of intrinsic currents. We know at least the T and the L type calcium channels, and we know NMDA receptors are involved that allow the semilunar granule cell to produce this plateau, but we still don't understand completely why the granule cells don't do this. And one thing, this is really unfortunate. If you record the input, so you activate in the perforant path at just threshold intensity, so you're looking at the minimal response, both these cell types have the same amplitude response. And we've done this at both recording this as an inward and an outward current. So you want to see an EPSC. This is a voltage clamp granule cell that's really small, but it's actually there. It's not on the projection. And that is the same between these cells. And if you flip this gradient, so now you're recording this EPSC as an outward response, that's also the same between the cells. But if you double the intensity necessary to trigger a minimal response, you increase the granule cell response, and these scales are different, but you increase the granule cell response much more than, much less than you increase the semilunar granule cell. So for some reason, if you activate individual axons, they produce about the same response. But if you activate many more axons, you get a much bigger increase in the EPSC on the semilunar granule cells and the granule cells. And this could be the density of the perforant path input, or it could be that there are other inputs that go selectively to these semilunar granule cells. We don't know that yet. Yes?
Think of dendritic spikes here?
Yes, that's why we did this in both directions. So if it's one possibility is that maybe these semilunar granule cells, because they have such big dendrites, are harder to clamp, right? And so the same input is more likely to trigger an unclamped calcium spike, and that's why this inward current gets bigger. And so by doing this at both, recording the same EPSP at two different potentials, we can eliminate that possibility because we see the same degree of enhancement from minimal to twice minimal stimulation when recorded as an inward-outward. Right. So these are the differences between these two cell types. The semilunar granule cells have this higher, presumably a higher density of synaptic inputs from the entorhinal cortex, but we haven't proven that yet. They have intrinsic currents that come into play when these inputs are activated that causes them to produce these beautiful plateau potentials, beautiful to us at least, and those plateau potentials produce this persistent spiking. And that persistent spiking then drives the synaptic barrages onto the downstream targets, right? In the slice, that's mostly these hyalur cells. And then the granule cells are inhibited, and we don't know if this inhibition comes from these hyalur interneurons coming back here, or if there are other interneurons up here that are driven by these semilunar granule cells. But this inhibition is probably functionally significant because the dentate typically acts as a gate. So if you have a take an entire animal and you stimulate the perforant path, stimulate back in the entorhinal cortex, you can stop. You typically see activity propagate through to the granule cell layer and then stop there, not move on into CA3. And one explanation in epilepsy is that this inhibition that stops the propagation of activity from the entorhinal cortex into the CA fields in the hippocampus is this granule cell inhibition, and that might be driven at least in part by these plateau potentials in the semilunar granule cells. So yes?
Do you have any idea how, if I look at the given MOSI cell and ask where it's receiving inputs from, what's the typical number of these semilunar granule cells that would project onto a given MOSI cell? How important are those inputs?
We don't know the connectivity yet. We can show it's relatively sparse, and I'll show you that in the next slide. We can estimate, as I said, from recording in the most physiological wake we can get in the brain slice, we can record cell attached here and see how fast do these cells fire on average. And then we can say how frequent are the EPSPs here at the same time. And that, adjusting for the failure rate, that gives you maybe six of these producing this, but it's probably much higher than that.
I have another question. Could you remind me where the perforant path stimulus is coming from?
So the perforant path is the name of the axons from entorhinal cortex that go into the hippocampus. And they terminate in the outer two layers. So we talked about the inner molecular layer where these magic cells are found. And the other two layers, the middle and the outer molecular layer, are termination zones of this perforant path input. Yes?
Can we trigger the ADP with current injection?
We can trigger a small ADP, but not nearly as long as this. And that small ADP looks like it's entirely made by T current. So we can we've imaged that with two-photon calcium dye imaging, and we can also block that with nickel. But we think then there's distal L-type calcium channels that maintain this plateau.
Right. That doesn't happen in granule cells.
Well, we haven't looked as much. We can't get this sort of response to synaptic drive very easily in granule cells. I mean, if you stimulate hard enough next to any cell, you can create an upstate. We can't turn this off with hyperpolarization. And that suggests that whatever the intrinsic currents that are mediating this plateau potential are probably distal. But it's also synaptically driven. To get this in our hands, to get this sort of long-lasting plateau, it has to be driven by the endogenous synapses. And so there could be much more complication that we don't know yet. All right. So the big question then, to relate this back to the working memory in the Pachelman-Arakis, is, well, is this just an upstate? Right? Is this just all the Hilar cells are going with this synaptic barrage? Or can we have subpopulations of Hilar cells that are going or not going based on which semilunar granule cells they're connected to? Do you have a code here that's entirely based on a one-to-one connection between whichever semilunar granule cells there are and these Hilar cells? And so the first order answer to that was that, oh, no. All right, you have to imagine the greeting here. So this is an experiment to get at that. So this is two stimulating electrodes. So we're activating two different parts of the perforant path. Right? And we're recording, so what we think is happening is we're reading out a sparse representation of which semilunar granule cells are activated because they have divergent projections within the hilus. And so we're recording that activity pattern by sampling three different MOSI cells. So it's a simultaneous triple recording, intracellular recording, from three, in this case, three MOSI cells. And when we activate this stimulation electrode in the perforant path, we see the synaptic barrage much higher on this cell, a little bit here, and almost nothing on this MOSI cell. And then if we activate a different stimulating electrode here, we see a very different pattern of this activity. Right? So there's more evenly distributed across these three MOSI cells. And so this is synapse specificity, which you don't see in the sort of generic upstates.
Those are single trials. Is that consistent from one trial to the next?
So that's the next two, right? So this is stimulation point of stimulus A, and then this is going back to stimulus A. And you still, it's not exactly the same, but you still see the rough correspondence here. And if the green projected better, you'd see very similar response to stimulus B on the second trial here. All right. So this is reproducible. In this particular experiment, we did this 10 times. Yes?
So is there some additional temporal patterns into that? So for example, here it seems that MC2 is initially active, maybe half a second, and then MC3.
Yes. So this is also why this is different than the sort of the classic intrinsic, the spinal cord model of intrinsic activity, where you have an ADP that's usually maximal right after the stimulus. So you have a step that turns on these calcium-activated inward currents, and then things decay. This is not that, because you see, in at least in some of these cases, a delay that is reproducible trial to trial. Right? And this also fits with our recordings from these semilunar granule cells. So they're spiking often, always does not begin right at the beginning of the stimulus. Sometimes there's a delay there. So there could be either a refractoriness in these semilunar cells, or there could be inhibition of semilunar cells that governs when they go into their plateau potential.
Do you also see plateau potential that stops short? Like, you know, it starts and then stops?
Or? It doesn't. The plateau potentials in the semilunar cranial cells are not abrupt like that. See if there's a better example. So here's one. This is an intracellular recording. So there's a leak associated with the intracellular recording, even in patch clamp. So you lose some of the spiking. But you can sort of imagine if you had more spiking, you'd still see most of the spiking several seconds after the stimulus.
But that's the semilunar neuronal cell. What about the MOSI fibers?
The MOSI cells, the MOSI cell synaptic barrages can be delayed too, and that's what this example is here. Right, that delay maybe corresponds to some semilunar cells that were delayed starting their plateau. All right, so this is four trials. We did the, in this particular example, we did this 10 times. So we did back and forth 5 times. Oh, wow. All right. So this is also more imaginations required. So one way to look at this is imagining as if this were, it's okay, I can show you, it's in the paper. So what we have here is a trajectory analysis. And so this was all done with triple recordings, but we're just showing you two, the most different two MOSI cells, just to put it into a two-dimensional plane. And so we can treat this as if it were an insect olfactory response, where you see patterns of activity that are sparse, that you only, in the insect, to tell what odor the animal was experiencing, you have to record from multiple projection neurons. And you look at the evolution of the response, and that's odor specific. And in the same way here, if we plot these two out of the three MOSI cell frequencies in time, so we see the frequency scale, we see the beginning response, they're hovering about the same spontaneous activity, but in response to these two B stimuli, they head off in this trajectory, and in response to the A stimulus, they head off in that trajectory. Right? And so we can produce population vectors that represent this activity in this case in two-dimensional space, but the real analysis was done in three dimensions, where we show their activity shifting from the basal to the first four seconds after the response for these two population responses here. So these are the individual population vectors from each episode. There are 5 of them here, 5 of them here. We average them. And then we can compare whether this is statistically different. Are these representations of these Hiler cell activities stimulus specific? And they are both in the absolute magnitude of these vectors and in the angle are statistically different. And then we can also do this by asking, can we produce a plane that statistically separates these two responses? Right? And so we've done that. We produced a plane in three-dimensional space formed by the frequency BPSP frequency of each of the intracellular recordings. And then we can measure the distance from that separation plane. And as we go, and these are in sequence, going from here to here to here, we bounce back on different sides of that plane. And then we can ask, is the distance from the plane statistically different between these two stimuli? And that's true in this experiment. And so we did this in the first paper we have on this. We did this in 7 experiments, and in 6 of the 7 experiments, this sort of analysis where you produce a separation plane in the three-dimensional space of the EPSP frequencies, were that produced a statistically significant separation. If we just randomized these, so we didn't know if this was a B or an A stimulus, none of those 7 produced statistically significant responses. And then once we have that separation plane, we can go back and we can say, if we have a snapshot, just a 1-second snapshot of the synaptic activity, can we tell whether it was an A or a B stimulus? And we can do that in the black dots here. We can do that with 1-second snapshots. We can do that out to 5 or 6 seconds after the stimulus. So this transient stimulus has created a spontaneous representation that is not global, but is cell-specific and is stimulus-specific. Right? And then we've gone on from there. Now we've got a stimulus array. And so we have four electrodes to stimulate four different spots of the inputs to the hippocampus. There are about 115 microns between each of these. And we're also doing this now, sampling the population with simultaneous triple recordings. And in this experiment, I think there are 15 episodes, so three to four repeats of each of them in different sequences. And doing the same pairwise comparison in the three-dimensional space produced statistically significant separation between each of these four. So we're representing, or transient stimuli is representing at least four different response patterns here. And doing that, this is averaged over 4 seconds, and we haven't looked beyond that. But presumably, there's much more temporal information there.
If you just use like the seconds three through four, or something like that, like you just use the late information, does it still work?
Yes, that is this. So these black dots are 1 second. Right, and we're looking at percent correct classification. This is cheating in a way, though, because this is using the separation plane over 4 seconds. We take the entire initial four seconds, well, to produce a separation plane. But then out here, by 5 or 6 seconds, this is data that wasn't even used in that plane. We're working on other ways that don't involve initially knowing what the separation plane is. But based on that, we can produce with these 1 second snapshots, we can produce accuracies in the 80 to 90%. So then I just wrap up by saying that we found a cell type that is in the hippocampal slice that no one had recorded from, but Cajal had described the morphology of beautifully, that have unusual properties and that they respond to perforant pass stimulation with a very strong EPSP once you get above the minimal intensities. Right? And that EPSP, and probably a large, the NMDA receptor-mediated component of that EPSP, helps trigger these, what we think are intrinsic plateau potentials that then trigger persistent firing. This persistent firing in these glutamatergic cells then produces these synaptic barrages that we see in downstream cells. And it's not a one-to-one mapping because we can see these Hyler cells having different responses to different parts of the perforant path. So we stimulate over here, we might see mossy cells that respond to both stimuli but respond in different ways, presumably reflecting different subgroups of these semilunar granule cells. And then we see this profound inhibition that lasts over many seconds of the granule cells that might be involved in the dentate gate. Yes?
Conclusion. So what is the very mechanism for this persistent activity in those cells here? So you say it's NMDA, so it's synaptic activity. So what is that mechanism?
So the mechanism we have pieces of. So the mechanism we know, we can block the underlying plateau potentials that drive this activity with NMDA receptor antagonists, with T-channel, calcium antagonists, and L-type calcium channel antagonists. Each one of those applied individually blocks nearly all of this plateau and then all of the downstream. So that implicates this being synaptically driven intrinsic plateau that's calcium channels that maintain it. But it's incomplete because we cannot, in the most clean case of an intrinsic plateau potential, like in the spinal cord where I started from, you can trigger with a depolarization of the soma. Right? But the spinal cord neurons might be much more electrotonically compact. These are cells that have enormous dendrites, and so we can't produce this long-lasting plateau with just somatic depolarization. So I think there's pieces of the mechanism we don't know. All we can say is it implicates intrinsic calcium channels in maintaining this and NMDA receptors in driving it, but it's not as simple as the spinal cord motor neuron. Yes?
So you argue about the dynamical creation of cell assemblies in the Hiller cell through the selective activity of specific mossy cells. Does that translate into also dynamical assemblies that are stimulus-specific in the granular cells activity?
We don't know that, and that's something we'd love to know, because there are two possibilities, is that this inhibition here is global, right? And that's the epilepsy view, that this inhibition is a break, and it doesn't matter whether there's a little bit of input here and here, as long as you reach some threshold, you trigger this global inhibition. The other possibility is this inhibition is a dynamic filter. So this inhibition here might be specific. It might be listening to which semilunar granule cells are on, and then enabling throughput by inhibiting only some of the granule cells.
Because the MOSIS cells have very strong projections onto the granule cells, right? So an assembly, a specific pattern of activity among the MOSIS cells might trigger a specific pattern of activity of granule cells, which then carry stimulus information.
Right, so this is two different worlds, which we'd love to span, but we can't span in one experiment, because the projections of the MOSIS cells are to granule cells, but they're to the granule cells far away, right? And so one possibility of interpreting this is that the reason the MOSI cells have these distant projections is related to this latch function, that specific entorhinal input patterns come through, they activate upstates in these Hilar cells that then modulate the depolarization bias of other granule cells. Right? But that is speculation. We can't get to those connections because they're out of the slice. Right? So we can get to the connections from the granule cell to the MOSI cell, but the projections back are largely lost. Right? And so I'll just end with this, that we come back to this, that we can show in a slice in these weird cells, and this is why this has probably been missed for all these years, that there are only a few labs that are recording from these weird Hilar cells. In the Hilar cells, you see stimulus specificity in a spontaneously occurring upstate. Right? In the same, has similar kinetics to the in vivo recordings from Packel-Marquis and Fuster that showed during working memory tasks, delay period activity for seconds. Right? So we don't know yet whether there might be in prefrontal cortex undiscovered cells that are rare but potentially more highly interconnected that drive this underlying synaptic barrage. This is extracellular, so we don't even know what the intracellular correlate that's driving this persistent spiking is in prefrontal cortex. But it might reflect some analog to this. So it's an alternative to the classic view that this is probably a reverberant synaptic circuit. This is a hybrid of a synaptically driven upstate, but it's initiated by these rare cells that have unusual properties. Yes?
Can you have a persistent activity in the slice of the prefrontal cortex?
So we haven't done this. Lots of people have recorded from that, and there's nothing that's obvious that's like this. The closest analog that we predict in cortex is in entorhinal cortex. We expect to see this sort of stimulus-specific ongoing upstates in entorhinal cortex slices that are treated with muscarinic receptor agonists.
You see it in cortical neurons all through neocortex treated with muscarin. That's been
right.
You can get that persistent activity.
But no one has, to our knowledge, no one has shown spontaneously active stimulus-specific upstates in any slice. This is the first time. And it's because we have these weird Hilar cells that listen so intensely to these semilunar cells. And so just end that this work was mostly from Phil Larimer, and then Robert Hyde is now continuing on that. And I didn't get a chance to talk about the rest of the olfactory bulb side. So thank you, and put you back on schedule.
So can I
read
the
paper
that you
with
one more question?
Sure.
So I read a couple of years ago what to me as a theorist was a very interesting paper from the Soltesh lab, where they look at the lenta gyrus and they look at the what they thought were the 8 most important cells in the lenta gyrus, which doesn't include these beautiful cells you were telling us about. And they concluded, they look at all the data that was not about the connectivity, and then they created many one-to-one networks that satisfy these connectivity requirements, and they concluded that the network was a small world.
Yes, that's the PNAS paper.
Yeah, and so to me that was very interesting because once you say it's a small world, there are very obvious network mechanisms for recurrence. So actually we had a paper where we look at a small world, reduced small world model, and we could understand the emergence of epilepsy according to their idea. You know, most these cells get destroyed, some of these long-range connections into the granule cell disappear, there is axonal sprouting among nearby granule cells, and if you just put these simple ingredients in a small world network of integrated fire neurons, you can understand where epilepsy is coming from. So, but in that picture, this is a purely network effect. So how does that picture come together with your ideas, if at all?
Well, so that paper is influential. And that paper built on work from John White that showed small world connectivity that might produce epileptic seizures. And to my knowledge, no one has shown an experiment demonstrating that a particular cell functions as a hub cell. That's the foundation of the small world network. That
a particular cell functions as
a hub cell that is...
No. It's a small world network. It's not a scale-free network.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't need hub cells.
There are specific connectivity that certain cells have.
You just need a combination of short range and long range connections.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need half cells as a scale free. It's a small world architecture, it's not a scale free architecture.
But so, still, this is not something that has been shown experimentally. Right?
And so
that the actual network evolves through that connectivity. And I think the semilunar granule cells are appealing in that they might be an example of a cell that could mediate this kind of small world behavior.
So, if I understand what it's meant to think very simply, NMDA synapses may be necessary to kind of go to the plateau and then the T-type calcium channels to maintain it.
Right.
So I know that if you block NMDA receptor in the peripheral cortex, you lose persistent activity. What happened if anybody tried to block T-type calcium?
I don't know. I mean, doing this in vivo is much more complicated, right? In the slice, we're able to just switch the bathing solution and we completely can eliminate T-current or L-type calcium current,
right?
In vivo, to ask, is, you know, sensory-driven persistent firing requiring L-type plateau potentials is much more complicated.
You can't just use blockers of this type of currents.
I thought there were no good blockers of T-type calcium.
So Nicol is one at a relatively low concentrations, but it's not. It will hit some other channels. Yes.
Yours can get graded also. If you do different amounts of depolarization versus stimulus, you can grade the fire rate.
Yes.
What turns off the persistent activity?
Oh, we'd love to know.
It's sort of decelerating, isn't it?
Yeah, we can't turn it off with hyperpolarization, but the anorinal experiments hyperpolarized it a lot, and so maybe that is also a partially distal mechanism. But it could be a biochemical mechanism that turns it off.
But I mean, but it's not a sharp switch off.
No.
Have you looked at, I mean, you talked about encoding information about like sort of a one-time transient input. Have you looked at trying to stimulate with more continuous?
Yes. The student who's continuing on this has now shown that the same, when you read out the population by sampling three cells, you can probably encode sequences. So we have some evidence that this encodes combinations of inputs differently than singles and also encodes specific sequences. So if we have four electrodes, we can see a different population representation where they go A, B, C, D, or B, D, A, C.
You looked at simultaneously activating two of those and
yes.
The superposition of the two.
Yeah, we're doing that now. We're doing that now. And it looks like the combination A plus B looks somewhat different than A or B, but we're still doing that data analysis.
Because it seems like it's different from the insect stuff you mentioned, where in the insects you get these very stereotyped temporal sequences, right? In your case.
The insects have a big advantage, and their whole olfactory system is wired to oscillate. Right? So the whole insect olfactory brain has a beautiful oscillation that locks these cell assemblies, right? And so it makes it much easier to read out. In vivo, this brain area also has oscillations, but we don't see much in the slice. So maybe what we're seeing is something more analogous to the insect olfaction, but just smeared out because we don't have the temporal.
Because the oscillations need these long range.
Yes.
Connections from mosaic to granular that you say get cut off on the side of the slide because they are not.
Well, thank you very much.
The shortcuts, the small shortcuts.
Thank you.